The following is a progressive roundtable discussion sponsored by the Madison Institute in Madison, Wisconsin, on March 3, 2007. The topic is the role of culture in the successful development of a society. The guest speaker, Dr. Lawrence Harrison, is a senior fellow in the Fletcher School of International Relations at Tufts University. He led a seminal multidisciplinary project called Culture Matters, which explored the role of culture in promoting or hindering achievement in democratic values, social justice, and economic well-being. Dr. Lawrence Harrison.
Since the 1960s, multiculturalism has become a dominant feature of the political and intellectual landscape of the West, and particularly in the United States and Canada, where immigration is significantly altering the ethnic and religious composition of both societies. Multiculturalism has also become a dominant theme in international development. For example, in the World Bank, where economic historian David Landis's assertion at a conference in 2000 that some cultures are toxic for development continues to reverberate very loudly and very negatively. But multiculturalism rests on a frail foundation, cultural relativism, the notion that one culture is not better or worse than any other. It is merely different. Anthropologist Ruth Benedict, author of the classic study of Japanese culture, The Chrysanthemum and the Sword, wrote that all cultures are, and I quote, coexisting and equally valid patterns of life which mankind has created for itself from the raw materials of existence. End of quote. In her view, each culture is self-contained, autonomous, separate but equal. Each makes sense in its own context, and all you have to do is know the context to understand what the people are doing and why they're doing it. That's doubtlessly good advice for anthropologists doing ethnographic studies in the field. If one's goal is full understanding of a value system quite different from one's own, ethnocentrism can seriously distort the quest and the conclusions. But what if the objective is to assess the extent to which a culture facilitates progress towards democratic governance, social justice, and an end to poverty, the goals of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. In this case, cultural relativism becomes a massive impediment because the assessment, presupposing that some cultures are more nurturing of progress than others, challenges the very essence of cultural relativism. Religion is a principal source of values, beliefs, and attitudes, the aspect of culture most relevant to the behaviors that influence the way a society evolves. Consistent with cultural relativism, there exists today a widespread presumption that all religions must be regarded as of equal worth and are in any event not to be the object of comparative value judgments. That presumption, let's label it religious relativism, is the dominant one in the West. However, when it comes to the relationship between religion and human progress, I find compelling evidence that some religions do better than others in promoting the goals of democratic politics, social justice, and prosperity. Voodoo, the dominant religion in Haiti, is a case in point. Haiti is by far the poorest, least literate, most misgoverned country in the Western Hemisphere. Voodoo is a religion of sorcery in which hundreds of spirits, very human and capricious, control human destinies. The only way to gain leverage over what happens in one's life is to propitiate the spirits through the ceremonial intervention of the voodoo priests and priestesses. Voodoo is without ethical content, and consequently a major contributor to the high levels of mistrust, paranoia, and sense of helplessness and despair noted in the anthropological literature about Haiti. Voodoo's roots are in the Dahomey region of West Africa, today the country of Benin. The indicators of income, child malnutrition, child mortality, life expectancy, and literacy are virtually identical for Haiti and for Benin. The roots of much of the population of Barbados are also in Dahomey. But unlike Haiti, which won its independence from France in 1804 through an uprising of slaves, Barbados gained its independence from Britain in 1966, at which time the descendants of the slaves dominated politics and the economy. During three centuries, they had so acculturated to British values and institutions that they are sometimes referred to as Afro-Saxons or Black Englishmen. The dominant religion is the Church of England. Today, Barbados is a prosperous democracy, number 30 on the 2005 UN Human Development Index, ahead of the Czech Republic, Argentina, Poland, and Chile. It is approaching first world status. In the wake of the unexpectedly broad impact of Culture Matters, which was published by Basic Books in the year 2000, co-edited by Samuel Huntington and me, I led the Culture Matters research project at the Fletcher School at Tufts, where I teach, from 2002 to 2005, with the participation of some 65 scholars, journalists, business people, and politicians around the world. The CMRP, as we refer to it, the Culture Matters Research Project, has produced three books: Developing Cultures, Essays on Cultural Change, co-edited by Harvard psychologist Jerome Kagan and me, and Developing Cultures, Case Studies, co-edited by Boston University sociologist Peter Berger and me. And then my overview of the entire project, The Central Liberal Truth, How Politics Can Change a Culture and Save It From Itself. Let me digress for just a moment to tell you about the source of the title, The Central Liberal Truth. About 10 years ago, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote in The New Republic an aphorism which has reverberated widely ever since. What he said was, "The central conservative truth is that it is culture, not politics, that determines the success of a society. The central liberal truth is that politics can change a culture and save it from itself." So this is sort of the second half of the aphorism of Senator Moynihan that you find on the cover of my latest book. Culture Matters, the 2000 book co-edited by Samuel Huntington and me, could have been called The Central Conservative Truth. Chapter 2 of The Central Liberal Truth is a typology of progress-prone and progress-resistant cultures. And the reason that we spent so much time working at it was because the question always came up theretofore, what are we talking about when we talk about culture? I mean, it's such a big term. Obviously, we're not talking about high culture, literature, music, and so forth. We're not talking about popular culture, rap, and so forth. We're talking about values, beliefs, and attitudes that influence the way people behave. Chapter 4 of The Central Liberal Truth is devoted to an analysis of 117 countries grouped by predominant religion, with each religion then tested against 10 indicators of political, economic, and social progress. The UN Human Development Index, which combines education, health, and per capita income indicators. Literacy, female literacy, fertility, degree of freedom, as measured by Freedom House, income distribution, trust, corruption, and per capita income. It is apparent from this analysis that Protestantism, Judaism, and Confucianism have been more successful at promoting progress than Catholicism, Orthodox Christianity, and Islam, not to mention Buddhism and Hinduism. Catholic Spain, Ireland, and the province of Quebec have all experienced transforming rates of economic and social progress, but in each case, the church's influence has diminished to the point where one hears the three societies referred to, that's Spain, Ireland, and Quebec, as post-Catholic. At the opposite end of the spectrum from voodoo and other traditional African religions are Protestant societies, above all the Nordic countries, Finland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Iceland, which I have labeled the champions of progress because of their repeated appearance at the top of virtually all of the 10 indicators, and others as well, for example, economic competitiveness, contributions to science. Jewish achievement is apparent not only in the case of Israel, the only first world country in the Middle East, and number 23 on the UN Human Development Index, ahead of Greece, Singapore, Portugal, and South Korea. The success of Jewish minorities all over the world is further evidence, as is the vastly disproportionate number of Jews awarded Nobel Prizes, about 20% of the total. Confucian societies like South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Japan, and Singapore, and now China itself, have repeatedly produced economic miracles. Chinese, Japanese, and Korean immigrants in countries as diverse as Indonesia, Brazil, Mauritius, and the United States are among the most upwardly mobile minorities. A recent New York Times article chronicled the hugely disproportionate presence of Asian American undergraduates in elite U.S. universities. Moreover, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Japan have built on economic success to consolidate democratic institutions. Islamic societies, even those with oil, have not produced economic miracles. Two predominantly Islamic countries, Indonesia and Malaysia, have experienced good but not transforming rates of economic growth. But the Chinese minorities in both countries have been the principal engines of that growth. In the case of Indonesia, the Chinese account for fewer than 5% of the population and something like 70% of the wealth, 70% of the wealth. As a group, the Islamic countries are the least free of all the world's major religions. Cultural and religious relativism from the domain of anthropology furnished the principal intellectual foundation of multiculturalism, but economics also contributes a pillar. Many economists would like to ignore culture. As the former World Bank economist William Easterly, author of The White Man's Burden, wrote in reviewing my book, Who Prospers, quote, "Maybe there is a lot to be said for the old-fashioned economist view that people are the same everywhere and will respond to the right economic opportunities and incentives." Easterly's view ignores a salient fact. In multicultural countries, where economic opportunities and incentives are available to all, some religious, some ethnic groups usually do or often do much better than majority populations, as in the case of the Chinese state diaspora mentioned above. Why has the Washington Consensus prescription of free market economics worked well in India and poorly in Latin America, where socialism and even authoritarian socialism, in the case of Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, appears to be alive and well, and where only Chile has been able to achieve transforming rates of sustained economic growth? Cultural factors are not the whole explanation, surely, but they are relevant. Alan Greenspan got it right when he said after the collapse of the Russian economy in 1988-1999, quote, "I used to assume that capitalism was human nature, but it was not human nature at all, it was culture." If culture matters, then, by influencing the degree of receptivity of a society to democratic institutions and the degree to which the society produces and encourages entrepreneurs, what are the implications for a foreign policy, a fundament of which is the doctrine, "These values of freedom are right and true for every person in every society," a fundament of the policy, foreign policy of the Bush administration, a doctrine suffused with multiculturalism and with roots going back at least to Woodrow Wilson? The Bush administration has staked huge financial, human, diplomatic, prestige resources on the doctrine's applicability in Iraq. It is now apparent that the doctrine is ungrounded. In the long run, Francis Fukuyama argues that all human societies will converge on the democratic capitalist model because it has proven itself to be the most successful way of harnessing human nature to produce progress. I agree. But what about the short run? What were the chances of consolidating democracy, not just elections, but also the full array of political rights and civil liberties, in Iraq, an Arab country with no experience with democracy and with two conflict-prone Islamic sects, Sunni and Shia, and an ethno-linguistic group, the Kurds, seeking autonomy? To assess the possibilities of a successful promotion of democracy in Iraq by a U.S. occupation, we might start with an assessment of the condition of democracy in Arab countries more generally. Freedom House's 2006 rankings, in which 2 is best and 14 worst, produce an average of 11 for 15 Arab countries, very close to the bad end, the worst end. By contrast, most first world countries are ranked 2 by Freedom House, including the United States and Canada. In those same 15 countries, the UN Human Development Report 2004 presents data on literacy that average out at 77% for males, 57% for females. More than half of females are illiterate in Iraq, Egypt, and Morocco. In Yemen, 70% of males are literate, 29% of females. While stable democracy may not depend on high levels of freedom, female literacy, as India, where female literacy is about 50%, demonstrates, it must surely be enhanced by literate women, particularly since women play the lead role in child rearing. The data on gender literacy underscore the subordination of women to men in contemporary Islam. If nothing else, the Iraq adventure demonstrates the enormous risks that attend a foreign policy predicated on a multicultural worldview. Development assistance institutions, both multilateral and bilateral, that would include the World Bank as a multilateral, USAID as a bilateral, have thus far failed to address cultural change, chiefly because culture-blind economists and anthropologists and other social scientists committed to cultural relativism have dominated policymaking. That some cultures are more prone to progress than others is a message that goes down very hard in development circles, the evidence to the contrary notwithstanding. This obstacle is magnified by the politics of the international institutions where both donors and recipients, the rich countries and the poor countries, have a voice, and where it is much more interpersonally comfortable and less threatening to self-esteem to view the countries lagging behind as either, one, the victims of the more successful countries, or two, as having failed thus far to find the proper content and mix of policies, incentives, and institutions. Representatives of this intellectual and emotional obstacle is the negative reception in some Arab circles to the four courageous UN Development Program Arab Human Development Reports published in each of the years 2002 to 2005 and co-sponsored by the Arab Gulf Program for United Nations Development Organizations. All four focus on the fundamental need for cultural change. The 2005 report calls for gender equality. To be sure, the World Bank, USAID, and other development institutions have been using anthropologists at least since the 1970s. But consistent with cultural relativism, their role has been to assure that projects adequately address culture as it exists, not to facilitate and encourage change. Symptomatic of the multiculturalist environment at the World Bank was an encounter I had after making a presentation on culture at a World Bank Poverty Reduction Conference a few years ago. During the question-comment period, an African employee of the bank said with fire in her eyes, "I thought we had put blaming the victim explanations behind us long ago." I can only hope that the persistent, widespread dissatisfaction and frustration with the slow pace of progress in most poor countries will cause development assistance institutions to ponder the message of culture matters and the central liberal truth. The considerable intelligence, creativity, and dedication of development professionals over the past half century have not succeeded in transforming the large majority of poor authoritarian societies. Where transformations have occurred, they usually have either been nurtured by cultures that contain progress-prone elements, the Confucian societies of East Asia, for example, or have been cases where cultural change has been central to the transformation, for example, Spain, Ireland, and Quebec. One of the principal lessons to come out of the Culture Matters Research Project, not to mention the Iraq venture, is that cultural change must be led from within a society. A critical mass of native political, intellectual, and religious leaders who recognize that some aspects of the traditional culture present obstacles to popular aspirations for a better life is indispensable. Efforts to encourage change from the outside or to enforce it with arms are likely to be resented, resisted, and labeled cultural imperialism. Development assistance institutions thus have a fine line to walk when it comes to cultural change. They should certainly familiarize themselves with the cultural change paradigm and be in a position to explain the paradigm and its applications to clients without pressing it on them. Cultural change is not easy, and the culture paradigm is not a magic wand. But adding culture and cultural change to the array of other development assistance tools, the more traditional ones, should significantly accelerate the rate of progress in those countries that choose to take the paradigm seriously. The foundation of multiculturalism is that all cultures are essentially equal, but what if they aren't? What if culture, not imperialism, colonialism, and dependency, is the principal reason that some countries are poor and authoritarian, while others are prosperous and democratic? What if culture is a key part of the explanation of Black and Latino underachievement in the United States? And what if some of the people who believe that to be true are themselves Latin Americans, Hispanic Americans, Africans, and African Americans? Two prominent Latin American contributors to Culture Matters and the Central Liberal Truth, the Argentine intellectual Mariano Grondona, the principal architect of the typology, and Cuban exile columnist Carlos Alberto Montaner, the most widely read columnist in the Spanish language, I might add, believe that Iberian cultural traditions like fatalism, disrespectful law, authoritarianism, a narrow radius of identification and trust, and disdain of economic activity have impeded Latin America's quest for democratic prosperity. So does author Mario Vargas Llosa. And in The Americano Dream, Mexican-American successful businessman Lionel Sosa argues that the same value system is an impediment to the upward mobility of Latin American immigrants in the United States. So does former U.S. Congressman Herman Badillo, a Puerto Rican whose recently published book, One Nation, One Standard, is both an indictment of Latino undervaluing of education and a call for cultural change. In Culture Matters, Cameroon's Daniel Etunga Mangale cites cultural factors as the chief cause of Africa's poverty, misgovernment, and strife. Fatalism, sorcery, authoritarianism, a communitarianism that suffocates both individual initiative and economic rationality. Those same factors have much to do with the ordeal of life for most Haitians, who also suffer the persisting scars of Haiti's slavery experience. Harvard sociologist Orlando Patterson, Jamaican by birth, emphasizes the culturally destructive impact of slavery in the United States in reaching the conclusion that culture is an important part of the explanation of African-American underachievement. African-American John McWhorter, author of Losing the Race and Winning the Race, wrote a paper summarized in the Central Liberal Truth in which he examines the antisocial behavior of black teenagers in a New York fast food restaurant, the manager of which was, by the way, also African-American, a reflection of a subculture that promotes a victim self-image, racial separatism, and the view that education doesn't matter. Washington Post foreign editor Keith Richburg reaches the same conclusion in his book, Out of America, A Black Man Confronts Africa. The well-being of African Americans depends above all on their finding their way into the progressive American cultural mainstream so profoundly shaped, like Canada's, by our Anglo-Protestant heritage. Other prominent African Americans who share this view include Ward Connolly, Bill Cosby, Thomas Sowell, and Shelby Steele. In his recent book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity, Samuel Huntington stresses the centrality of Anglo-Protestant culture to America's success. Among the elements of that culture, rule of law, fair play, individual rights, limits on governmental authority, a blend of individualism and sense of community, freedom, including freedom of religion, an ethical code that breeds trust, work ethic, and a commitment to human progress, importantly through education. These values are substantially shared by the most advanced countries of the world, for example, the countries of Northern Europe, but they are not commonly found in the countries of the Islamic world, Africa, and Latin America. Trust is a particularly important cultural factor for progress toward all three goals of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights: democratic governance, social justice, and prosperity. Trust in others reduces the cost of economic transactions. Democratic stability depends on it. Trust is periodically measured in 81 countries by the World Values Survey. Four Nordic countries, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and Finland, enjoy very high levels of trust. 58% to 67% of respondents in these countries believe that most people can be trusted. By contrast, 12% of respondents in Zimbabwe and South Africa, 8% in Tanzania and Uganda, and 3% of Brazilians believe that most people can be trusted. Canada's commitment to multiculturalism was initially driven by the birth of the country as a bicultural society. Biculturalism has been costly, and not just in the burdens that bilingualism imposes on any society. Until recent decades, Quebec was far behind Anglophone Canada with respect, for example, to per capita income, education, and industrialization. And the gap bred resentments that found expression in complaints that Quebec was being exploited. The gap closed substantially after Quebec's silent revolution of the 1960s, which sharply reduced the influence of the Catholic Church. Yet ironically, as the Anglophone and post-Catholic Francophone cultures converged, a large Quebecois separatist constituency emerged, and the issue of sovereignty for Quebec is still a burning issue in Canada. Quebec's history demonstrates a huge potential cost of multiculturalism, a divided society. Had British Governor Guy Carleton in 1774 chosen to push English and acculturation to British values and institutions on Quebec rather than enable perpetuation of the French language and culture, relationships between the two Canadas would surely have been most difficult for a generation or two. But today, Canada would be a unified nation in all probability. Hispanic Americans, poorer and less educated than African Americans, now form the largest U.S. minority and are projected by the Census Bureau to constitute about 25% of the more than 400 million Americans that the Census Bureau projects as the low end of their projection for the year 2050. Their experience in the United States recapitulates Latin America's culturally shaped underdevelopment. For example, the Hispanic high school dropout rate in the United States is alarmingly high, about 25%. It is a good deal higher in Latin America, where education has had much lower priority than in the United States and Canada. And Latin America's sluggish economic growth reflects in part an entrepreneurial shortfall influenced by the cultural factors that Lionel Sosa highlights in his book, The Americano Dream. The progress of Hispanic immigrants, not to mention harmony in the broader society, depends then on their acculturation to the values of that broader society. Efforts, for example, long-term bilingual education to perpetuate Latin values in a multicultural salad bowl work against acculturation to the mainstream and upward mobility, and are likely to result in continuing underachievement, poverty, resentment, and divisiveness. So does the willy-nilly emergence of bilingualism in the United States. No language in our history has ever before competed with English to the point where one daily hears commercial enterprises responding to telephone calls with, "If you want to speak English, press 1. Si quiere hablar en español, oprima el botón número 2. Highly evocative of Alexis de Tocqueville's paramount conclusion in Democracy in America are Samuel Huntington's words in Who Are We? And I quote, "Would America be the America it is today if it had been settled not by British Protestants, but by French, Spanish, or Portuguese Catholics? The answer is no. It would not be America. It would be Quebec, Mexico, or Brazil." The experience of immigrants from China, Korea, and Japan contrasts strikingly with that of Hispanics. The East Asians' rapid upward mobility is evidenced by their vastly disproportionate numbers at our most prestigious universities mentioned above. The success of these Confucian Americans reminds us both of the East Asian miracles of the last several decades, initially economic but now in several cases political, and the parallels between Confucianism and the Protestant and Jewish ethics. Emphasis on the future, education, work, merit, savings. These values form a system that works in as widely divergent geographic settings as Iceland, Israel, and Taiwan. That system might be labeled universal progress culture. The immigration debate in the United States has been largely framed in economic terms, although border security and environmental concerns are also clearly in play. The pro-immigration view that has produced such odd bedfellows as the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal has been reinforced by the rapid growth in numbers of Hispanic voters, which has induced both political parties to woo Latinos. But immigration looks very different when viewed in cultural terms, particularly with respect to the vast legal and illegal Hispanic immigration, perhaps as many as 750,000 people a year, most of them with few skills and little education. The power of culture for good and bad was captured a few years ago by Mexican journalist Mauricio González de la Garza after a visit to California, and I quote him, "Seeing San Diego, one becomes aware of what Mexico could be if it hadn't experienced a demographic explosion and an explosion of corruption, graft, and nepotism, and political, moral, social, and economic degradation. To be sure, America has absorbed large numbers of unskilled and uneducated immigrants in the past. And today, the large majority of their descendants are in the cultural mainstream. They have melted. But the number of immigrants and their geographic concentration today leave real doubts about their prospects for acculturation. As an example, 70% of children in the Los Angeles public schools and 60% of children in the Denver schools are Hispanic." In a letter to me in 1991, the late Mexican-American columnist Richard Estrada captured the essence of the problem. He wrote, The problem in which current immigration is suffused is, at heart, one of numbers. For when the numbers begin to favor not only the maintenance and replenishment of the immigrant source culture, but also its overall growth, and in particular, growth so large that the numbers not only impede assimilation, but go beyond to pose a challenge to the traditional culture of the American nation, then there is a great deal about which to be concerned. The current intense debate over our failed immigration policies focuses on such economic issues as, does the economy need more unskilled immigrants? If so, how many? Do immigrants take jobs that citizens don't want, or do they compete with citizens for low-paying jobs? How much of a fiscal drain is attributable to immigrants, for example, with respect to education and health expenditures? Is population growth importantly driven by immigration necessary for a healthy economy? The cultural issue should be added to the debate. If multiculturalism is a myth, how do we avoid the woes that will inevitably attend the creation of an enduring and vast underclass, alienated from the upwardly mobile cultural mainstream? Two policy implications are apparent. First, the flow of immigrants must be calibrated not only to the needs of the economy, but also to the capacity of the United States to assure acculturation of the immigrants. And second, as with immigration flows of the late 19th and early 20th century, an extensive program of activities designed to facilitate acculturation, including mastery of English, should be mounted. A law declaring English to be the national language is one measure that would be helpful in this respect. The cost of multiculturalism in terms of disunity, the clash of classes, and declining trust are likely to be huge in the long run. All cultures are not equal when it comes to promoting progress, and very few can match Anglo-Protestantism in this respect. The U.S. and Canada should be promoting acculturation to the national mainstream, not a mythical utopian multiculturalism, and they should take care that the Anglo-Protestant virtues that have brought them so far do not fall into disrepair.
Two panelists were invited to comment on Dr. Harrison's book, The Central Liberal Truth, and on today's talk. The first to speak is Paul Beckett. Now retired from the African Studies Department at the UW-Madison, Paul specialized in the politics of African countries, especially Nigeria.
I have just a few things to say in two categories. The first is concerns that I have about the Culture Matters movement. It makes me think of that sort of patter song that is in the musical My Fair Lady, where Henry Higgins asks the question, well, why can't women be more like men? And so the way it reminds me of that is I wonder whether in making this Culture Matters argument and the points that Larry has made today, aren't we asking these poor countries, the vast majority, by the way, of the population in the country, why can't they be more like us? You know, Larry Harrison in his book suggests that culture matters participants or aficionados are mistakenly identified as conservative. And he says toward the end of the book, it's not a conservative argument. And I can see the basis of his argument, but I do have to say as a reader that a number of the points that are made do seem to me to dovetail perfectly with the philosophy that underlies the conservative and even the neoconservative or neocon movement. Thus, my personal reaction as a reader is that while there are a lot of very interesting points, many of which were made orally today, a lot of really good things to think about, I find myself thinking that this is a conservative line, and I find that it's one that shares a great deal with the cultural imperialisms of the past. In other words, which served as ideologies supporting the British Empire, the French Empire with its civilizing mission, or for that matter, the Roman Empire. And he mentioned Iraq, and it seems to me the simplified notion of why can't they just be more like us absolutely runs through the U.S.-Iraq invasion and the philosophy of our occupation. When I think about real-world situations that I know fairly well, I have a couple of more or less intuitive reactions or senses. The first is that the line here, even though it does, you know, it brings out a lot of interesting ideas and a lot of interesting facts, vastly oversimplifies the complexity and continuity of human situations, including politics and economic development. And secondly, I find myself feeling again more or less at the intuitive level that we often, as in Iraq at present, would do much better to exercise our brains to understand them rather than telling them that they just need to be more like us. I used to work a lot on Nigeria, and I thought about Nigeria as I read the book, and I did want to acknowledge that I think most intellectual Nigerians, and maybe taxi drivers for that matter, would agree, really, that culture really does matter. And specific to Nigeria, I think they would agree that the problems of Nigeria, which, as you know, are just fantastic, come out of aspects of their culture. They're always accusing themselves of being corrupt. They're always accusing themselves of what they like to call indiscipline, which includes corruption, but also might extend to, I don't know, national laziness. You've never heard people who are more self-critical, you know, in terms of culture than Nigerians tend to be. And I've been following this now for, 20 to 30 years. I feel that this self-criticism, this focus on culture is very deeply felt. There have actually been organized efforts along the lines, I think, that we are advocating here. For instance, there was a war against indiscipline, WAI, W-A-I it was called. And the head of state, you know, would announce the war against indiscipline. I see more recently the governor of one of Nigeria's states has going a campaign called Kick Against Indiscipline. So in a sense, they're working on this. They're really trying. What have the results been? I don't know. Somehow they've been zero, you know, zilch. That kind of ties back, in a sense, I think, to my point that it's really awfully complicated and perhaps much more complicated, multifarious in terms of, you know, causalities and everything than we are acknowledging here. It puzzles me. It puzzles Nigerians. I happened onto an article in the November 13th New Yorker. It's a wonderful article about Lagos, the former capital of Nigeria, and one of the great mega cities of the world, which is getting a lot of academic attention along with other attentions. And if you want to be horrified, I'd really suggest you read it. Also fascinated, because it's in Lagos now, this conglomeration has something like 15 million people in it. I imagined, as I read this, taking central liberal truths to people there and explaining to them, how they can get out of this. And suddenly, it illustrates what I mean. You just realize it's so much bigger than this kind of argument. And anyway, those are some concerns about the arguments themselves. My category two was, in a sense, possibly more important. It's what this argument causes us not to focus on or not to look at so much. And I think all of us here in this room would agree that the organization of the world is profoundly favorable to them that has, to the rich nations, to the rich people, and that it has been cruel and really economically impenetrable for most of the rest. Around 1980, structural adjustment programs were imposed on a majority of developing countries, very much including the African ones. They were aimed at making them structurally more like us. The focus may have been structural, but they certainly were imposed in the hope that culture would change to fit. And yet, at present, 20% of the world's populations consume 86% of the world's goods. 80% of humanity share the remaining 14%. looking at Africa, I can only think that things continually get worse and the gap between us and them widens. Culture, of course, is part of it. But the point I want to make here is there's a lot more besides the cultural factor. I would say that economically, as we look around the world, the deck really is stacked. Where are countries like Mali supposed to go? Let me just give one fairly current example. Cotton is grown in apparently about 20 million African farmers either grow cotton or would like to grow cotton to cover their subsistence. Certainly it would be an important crop in northern Nigeria and Mali, various other countries, East Africa. But good luck. The U.S. subsidizes its cotton production and exports by the tune of 86 cents for every dollar of value, according to an Oxfam report. It makes the situation impossible for African countries. You know, forget cotton. So what else are you going to grow? This kind of situation sends young people in droves from the farms and the rural areas and the smaller cities to the capital cities. And Lagos is a disaster, as I said, of 15 million people. These situations likewise result in tens of thousands of African young people. Each one of them innately as valuable as our own children, making the perilous trips across the Sahara and out into the Atlantic in open boats, as from Senegal, in efforts to escape to one of the favored countries of the world. And every year, thousands of these people die. And most of the rest don't satisfy their dream. And one thing we have to remember is that this is terrible for them, but this immigration problem and the lack of opportunities in poor countries is bad for us as well as for them. And so I feel that we really perhaps can't go on, and certainly should not go on, with our part of the world getting richer and richer, literally filthy rich, while the rest, containing vast numbers, is steadily more impoverished. We can tell the impoverished billions that they need to be more like us, but at best, I think this will be kind of a tiny part of the solution. And thus, while I appreciate very much the efforts and the intentions within the Culture Matters Project, I do worry that it distracts us from the real challenge that faces us. And at the worst, it might lead us to some extent to blame the victims.
The second panelist is Joseph Elder, professor of sociology and languages and cultures of Asia at the UW-Madison. His specialty is the sociology of contemporary India.
Let me go back to one of Larry Harrison's first point. Larry was very critical about the concept of multiculturalism, and he picked up from a statement of Ruth Benedict, who was, to some extent, a founder of American anthropology, and the idea of cultures being sort of unique phenomena, almost like little vessels. And they had to be kept isolated from each other because once the vessel cracked, it ended. Well, I would say that was a false impression of culture, unless you're dealing with really, really, really isolated cultures. Cultures are porous. With generations, they change. With meeting other groups of people, they change. And the notion that there is a culture which just stands by itself and then it comes in and stands beside another culture, and these don't fuse back and forth with each other, I think is historically inaccurate. And it leads to one of my major criticisms about the whole notion of the clash of cultures. When one looks at this notion that here is the Western culture and here's the Sinic cultures, and here are the Muslim cultures, and somehow they're antagonized to each other, one can't teach a course, as I'm currently doing, on the social structure of Muslim societies without seeing how these things really flow back and forth, borrowing ideas from each other constantly. And the idea that these are separate and they're clashing, maybe in some way they do clash, but probably more importantly, they flow back and forth. And I think evidence of that, and Larry mentions this, is the fact that we do have a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And this isn't just a Western declaration. This is something which every nation in the United Nations has signed onto. And there are three components of this, one of which I would say was pretty American-European. One is pretty Soviet Marxist, and one is pretty Third World. Let me point them out. And all the countries have signed onto these things. The first maybe 20 points of the Universal Declaration are the ones we're familiar with. Freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of political parties, voting, and so on. Then there's kind of a click. I think it's Article 24. And suddenly these are the Marxist notions of work, of health, of food, of security, the whole basis of the need to recognize that societies have responsibility for jobs, for retirement, and so on, which aren't in the American creed, but certainly were part of the Marxist creed. And then we come to the so-called protocols, or there's the Universal Declaration, and then there are the covenants. And when the covenants were written, the third worlds began to have a voice. And they speak of the right to one's culture, to one's language. And these weren't even mentioned in the first two parts. So we have a world already with three different components, more than three, and the Universal Declaration of Rights, which is subscribed to by all the nations in the UN, except this broad interpretation, which includes what we think of as civil liberty, civil rights, economic rights, and cultural rights. So I don't see multiculturalism as there and then this entity that we're working on over here. We are a world, and in the UN and in the Declaration of Human Rights, we have shared commonalities, which we may emphasize part of and others may emphasize other parts of, but they certainly aren't exclusive and they emerge from flowing together. In looking at Larry Harrison's book, the title is sort of different from the body. The title suggests that it's going to be political values that shape culture. I think that's actually in the title where it says, "The Central Liberal Truth, How Politics Can Change a Culture and Save It from Itself." So it looks as though the title said, how do we come up with political formulae that change culture? But then the body of the book is looking at what do cultures do that shape political entities. When one looks at some of the economic miracles that have occurred, culture sort of fades away. And these seem to be policies or creativity that suddenly worked. For example, Bogota. What happened there? There were some very clever mayors who did something that changed the economy of Bogota. Ireland, which was sort of a lost part of the world. And then all of a sudden there was a decision to open up the economy. There were the plans to join the European Economic Community. There was Ireland's creation of the Industrial Development Authority. And within 10 or 15 years, Ireland emerged from where it was sort of nothing to where it was one of the dynamos of Europe. And these were policies. The Irish Catholics didn't trigger it. It was a series of pretty smart policies, done indeed by Irish people, but looking at the way in which the world operated and then putting themselves in a position. Sub-Saharan Africa is barely mentioned in Larry's book. And yet if one wants to find a part of the world that has been locked in a trap, it's there. One can imagine people, and I think Paul, you mentioned the Lagos. How can anybody in Lagos prosper at all? The section of the world that I've seen people working very, very hard, hoping for their kids to achieve, and stuck in kind of a cell that won't work is Nepal. I've been in the hill areas of Nepal where a farmer will get up before dark, before dawn, work all day on his terraces. Hope that there isn't a heavy rainfall that washes his terrace away. And at the end of the year, he's eating tomorrow what he makes today. And he's working, and his wife is working, and his kids are working as hard as they possibly can. But trapped in a situation with as little land and as few resources, they have no other place to go unless they're going to sort of leave the farm and go to Kathmandu, which has probably grown 8 or 10 times what it was 20 years ago, with all the problems that were being mentioned here about lack of jobs and so on. China. The Chinese Confucianism didn't change between Mao Zedong and the sort of new innovation. It was a radically different ideology that introduce market forces into the Chinese economy, ironically keeping the Marxist slogans that to be capitalist is to be Marxist, to make money is a Marxist sort of thing. And here is a country that for 20, 25 years has been the most rapidly growing economy in the world, and it doesn't fit particularly well into Larry Harrison's scheme, because there wasn't that much of a cultural shift as there was a shift in strategy. So the same people who, in a sense, quietly resented Mao Zedong and who put up with the Cultural Revolution now are vigorous entrepreneurs. And it seems to me it was a policy that opened things up so the people could do things rather than being a change from the beginning. Again, looking at the world from a slightly different point of view, the notion of one language is crucial for a country to thrive. I was in India when India made the decision not to force everybody to learn one language. And within the first 15 years of India's existence, the decision to be a multinational country saved it from what would have been, I think, a serious fragmentation into perhaps 10 or 20, 10 or 15 smaller countries. So the policies vary from place to place, and I would have some question about saying, should we make English mandatory? It increases problems if there are people who speak other languages, but is the price that one might pay a more severe in consequence? So let me sort of wind up. Mostly I want to compliment Larry Harrison for pulling together a lot of interesting information, that even with one may not agree with all the conclusions or even the basic premise, there's some rich data here for which we will ever be grateful. Thank you, Larry.
Next, Dr. Harrison responds to several of the comments of the panelists.
I'm a great fan of My Fair Lady, and I know the song very well. But I want to stress that my message is not, and nor the message of my colleagues, is not that they have to be like Westerners, that they have to be like us. And indeed, we're not in a position where we should be telling them that. It's a question of their aspirations to the standard of living, to the democratic institutions, to the rule of law that exist in our society that don't in theirs. And the question is, how do they get those wonderful assets in life that they have been deprived of? And our answer is, your values and attitudes may be obstacles to that, but if they're going to change, we can't change them. You're going to have to change them yourselves. I hope it's clear to everybody that none of us think that race has anything to do with culture. Culture is something that's acquired starting from the first days of life in the home, in the school, the church, the playground, and wherever, through the media, importantly. So let's not think in terms of racial explanations. Let me go on to the title of Central Liberal Truth. The reason that I'm so comfortable with the title is because of the last chapter, which is what I have been shooting for the last quarter of a century. And it is the guidelines for progressive cultural change. And it's far from definitive, probably some errors in it, but it's the first time to my knowledge that in a fairly coherent way, the lessons of experience have been compiled in guidelines. And these guidelines, of course, form the structure of the new Cultural Change Institute. Let me go on to the question of some of the countries that have changed, have experienced transformations. The subject of China was mentioned, I think, by Joe. Confucian culture didn't change. It's still there. What you have is conflicting currents. The currents that you have in Confucianism that are relevant to the recent miraculous economic performances have to do, on the one hand, with the Protestant ethic, like emphasis on education, achievement, discipline, frugality, merit, those five that I've just mentioned, conducive to economic development wherever you find them. And on the other hand, a set of values with respect to politics and social structure that are highly conservative, authoritarian. This is really the crucial question. Is a Confucian society promoting economic development or standing in the way of it? And in the old tradition, it stood in the way of it because economic activity was at the lowest level, lowest rung of the prestige ladder. Above it were the craftsmen, the farmers, the warriors, and of course at the top, the mandarins, the intellectual political leaders. So when you have that sort of suppressing of this Protestant ethic-like core of values, you don't get very much economic progress. But in every case, once you get a government saying, to get rich is glorious, which is what Deng Xiaoping said, what you have is a spectacular response, and that's true in South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and the Chinese diaspora. The point that there are some oversimplifications in the book is clearly warranted, but I have tried to make it clear what some of the other factors are that influence the way societies evolve. And economic policy is clearly one of the most important of them. You've got the same basic culture in North Korea and South Korea. You have a spectacular success in the South, a spectacular failure in the North. You have India, a country which for 40 years, 45 years, poked along at what was used to be labeled the Hindu rate of growth, you know, barely a little bit more than the growth of the population. And suddenly something happens. And we now are seeing in India sustained very high level rates of growth, and it's related to an economic policy change, one which moved away from the socialist Nehruvian line to a more open economy. I might add on the subject of India that the language issue is a very different one there. English they tried to suppress, they couldn't, and it has turned out to be a wonderful thing that they didn't, because an important asset in the Indian economic miracle has been English. Let me conclude by saying culture changes, there's no question about it, and economic policy changes have often been the trigger. In some cases, they have met resounding response because of ongoing qualities in the culture, like in the Confucian countries, with the emphasis on work and merit, education, and so forth. In some cases, the culture has changed significantly. And this is the case, for example, with Spain, Ireland, Quebec. It's true that economic policy openings in all three cases, well, in at least in two of them, in the case of Ireland and Spain, were central to the change. But the economic policy opening provoked a whole set of reactions, in the case of Spain, for example, that meant the fortifying in a very strong way of its links with Europe, and exposure of Spanish intellectuals, priests, politicians to Western Europe, and workers. A lot of sojourner workers went from Spain to work in France and Germany and so forth after the war. Today, measured by the World Value Survey, Spain is a totally different, well, I shouldn't say totally is an exaggeration, a substantially different culture from what it was 50 years ago. The case of Quebec, one of the central elements was not so much a change in economic policy, but a removal of the church from the education sector and from political influence.
To learn more about the Cultural Change Institute and outgrowth of the Culture Matters Project, go to fletcher.tufts.edu/CCI. That's fletcher.tufts.edu/CCI. Audio recordings of this and other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speaker, and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.